Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group and Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, February 1st, 2018, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon's topic is the False Claims Act Granston Memo. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Brandon J. Moss, Associate at Wiley Ryan. After our speaker's remarks, we'll open the floor for audience questions. Thank you for speaking with us, Brandon. The floor is yours.
Hi, everyone. Well, as Laura nicely said, the goal for today is to share a little bit about the so-called Granston Memo, which is the latest development in the False Claims Act world. First, after a very short background bit on the False Claims Act, I'm going to talk about the substance of the memo for a bit. Then we can turn to possible implications and what people have said about the memo, focusing, of course, on the key question, how much does the memo really move the needle on the status quo? First, and very quickly, about the FCA. The False Claims Act is also known as Lincoln's Law. It dates back to the Civil War when it was originally passed by Congress as a way to prevent fraud against the Union Army. It's the primary tool of the Department of Justice for fighting fraud against the government. It generally prohibits the knowingly presenting or causing to be presented a false or fraudulent claim for payment or approval, but it does come in a couple different varieties. For example, there's a reverse False Claims Act provision. There's also a provision of the False Claims Act that prevents retaliation against whistleblowers. There are four key elements to the False Claims Act. First, there has to be a claim or statement for payment or approval of payment. The statement or claim has to be false or fraudulent. It has to be done with knowledge of the falsehood, so actual knowledge, reckless disregard, or deliberate ignorance. And the claim has to be material. The biggest thing to keep in mind with False Claims Act is it has to be an intentionally false claim for payment. Fraud is really what separates an FCA action from a typical contract dispute with the government. The signature of the FCA is that it can be brought by the government or it can be brought by someone called a relator. A relator is a civilian person who has independent knowledge of the potential falsity and can bring the case himself. Almost anyone with original knowledge of the fraud, so-called, can be a whistleblower and bring the case. This includes people who know something because they were a part of it or because they know of something who knows someone who does it. Most of the time, these are employees or former employees. What happens is a whistleblower can file a case under seal, and then they have to deliver the copy of the complaint to the U.S. Attorney's Office for the district in which they filed and the Department of Justice. The case remains under seal until the government decides whether or not it wants to intervene or take over the case. If the government declines intervention, the relator can continue without the government's assistance. False Claims Act strikes fear in the hearts of those who do business with the government because it provides treble damages and penalties. It's a heavy hammer, so there's an added incentive to settle regardless of the case's merits. Now, about the memo. The memo, which, of course, was not publicly released, it was actually picked up by the National Law Journal, query how they got it, but it is marked for internal use only. was issued on January 10th, and it came to light last week. The memo is titled Factors for Evaluating Dismissal Pursuant to 31 U.S.C. 3730C2A. That provision provides that the government may dismiss an action notwithstanding the objection of the person initiating the action if the person has been notified by the government of the filing of the motion and the court has provided the person with an opportunity for a hearing on the motion. Essentially, if the government decides not to intervene in a case, it can also decide to affirmatively decline a relator's case and move for dismissal. Despite the presence of this provision statute, though, the government has only used this option in less than 1% of the False Claims Act cases that they've declined. The memo lays out potential rationales for dismissal, use of this provision, and directs that, quote, when evaluating a recommendation to decline intervention in a key TAM action, A QTAM, by the way, for those who might not know, is the action brought by the relator. Attorneys should also consider whether the government's interests are served in addition by seeking dismissal. The memo cites that dismissal remains an important tool in, to advance the government's interests, to preserve its limited resources, and to avoid adverse precedent. The memo talks a little bit about the things that would bring this into light now as opposed to before. For example, there's been a record increase in False Claims Act cases brought, annual totals of more than 600 at this point. And even when the government doesn't intervene, it expends significant resources monitoring non-intervened cases and in just responding to reasonable discovery requests of the parties. Also, cases that lack merit can generate bad law, adverse decisions that could affect the government's ability to enforce the FCA in meritorious cases down the road. The memo describes 7 factors attorneys should look at when they're making these decisions. I'm going to go through these factors quickly, and then we can talk a little bit about what all this means. The first one is an obvious one, but extremely important. It's attorneys should consider whether or not dismissing would result in curbing meritless QTAM claims. There are 2 ways that cases can be seen as meritless. First, it can be facially lacking in merit. The complaint itself shows that there's no merit to the case. It could be that there's a legal defect that's obvious on its face. For example, a case that failed to allege the submission of a false claim or an actionable obligation to support a reverse false claim in a reverse false claim case. Or it could be that the factual allegations on the face of the complaint are frivolous. For example, there's no allegation that the defendant was in a position to receive federal funds or associated with a federal program. Or the government could make this conclusion after it has done its intervention investigation. Interestingly, the memo does make the obvious point here, or what might not be obvious, but is very important, that these cases in which it could be declined after the investigation shows that the case is meritless have been rare historically, in part because to maximize the government's resources, it typically will investigate a QTAM action only to the point where it concludes that the declination is warranted. This may not equate to a conclusion that the fraud did not occur. If the department is concerned the case lacks any merit, but elects to afford the relator an opportunity to further develop the case, the department attorney may consider advising the relator that dismissal will be considered if the relator is unable to obtain additional support for the relator's complaint by a specified date. Significantly, obviously, this is the thing you think of most when you think of reasons to affirmatively dismiss a case. The case has no merit. But it's not a baseline for the memo. The memo points out that all the 7 factors are both not exclusive, nor are they inclusive. You can move to dismiss for any one of the reasons, for multiple reasons, or even for reasons that aren't listed in the memo. The second factor to consider is preventing parasitic or opportunistic QTAM actions. These are cases that either clearly duplicate an existing government investigation and that do not bring new information to the table. For example, it would be reasonable to dismiss a case that is duplicative of an existing government investigation that's been going on for years and years, and they have plenty of evidence to bring forward, but they haven't yet, especially if the relator doesn't bring anything new to the table. They don't want the relator to receive an unwarranted windfall because the government has already done the legwork. The rationale for this is that Congress created the whistleblower provision to incentivize and reward the provision of meaningful information and assistance instead of merely providing duplicative information already known to the government. The third factor is preventing interference with agency policies and programs. When an agency determines that a QTAM action threatens to interfere with its own policies and the administration of its programs, the government, the DOJ, might consider declining the case and moving for dismissal. It could be that the action would delay projects or programs via diversion of agency personnel or resources. It could be that the allegations in the suit would hinder the flow of information in a public-private partnership. Or it could be a situation where the case both lacks merit and raises the risk of significant economic harm that could cause a critical supplier to exit the government program or industry. With respect to that last theory, the government actually cited the guardrail case down in Texas on the theory that, yes, while the claims put in weren't exactly what was asked for, the Highway Administration already knew that and had decided that the guardrails provided were acceptable, and it had no interest in it moving forward. And they wanted to keep the Trinity as a supplier. The fourth is controlling litigation brought on behalf of the United States. They're to consider dismissal when it would protect the department's litigation progress. There are a couple of examples given. For example, a situation where a relator brought a case against 300 different defendants and the government wants to intervene just a few, it might want to dismiss the others so that it doesn't cause an impediment to the meritorious litigation. Also, a big one here that they didn't flesh out but I think is pretty significant is that they want to avoid the risk of unfavorable precedent. Just last year, the Supreme Court decided Escobar. It's an implied False Claims Act case, which verified that that was a plausible way to go forward, but also brings up the question of materiality, especially with respect to government knowledge. There's been a split on the circuits as to whether or not a claim can be material if the government knew about it and accepted payment anyway. The government is not interested in more cases that make that point more clearly for defendants. So if it can avoid that kind of materiality decision by dismissing, it might consider doing that. They also might dismiss an unintervened case to the extent that that case is an obstacle to settling an intervened case. For example, there could be multiple cases brought against a single defendant. That defendant wants a universal ruling, but you can't get that if there's an unintervened case out there. Excuse me, a universal settlement. The fifth factor is safeguarding classified information and national security interests. This is particularly in cases involving intelligence agencies and military procurement. These are meritless cases that pose an undue risk of disclosing classified material and that generally pose an unacceptable risk to national security if prosecuted in public. Also, number six, they want to preserve government resources. Key question here right now is, do the expected cost exceed any expected gain? The amount of money involved doesn't justify litigation that would mitigate in favor of dismissal. The memo also interestingly gives a nod to the FAR, specifically provision 31.205-47C, which allows successful defendants to recover a portion of their litigation expenses connected with certain types of contracts. In other words, if the defense contractor wins, they could get, I think it's up to 80% of their litigation costs back. The seventh and final factor listed is addressing egregious procedural errors. These are problems with a relator's action that frustrate the government's efforts to conduct a proper investigation. Example given here is a relator who refused to serve the complaint on the government and then wouldn't cooperate with the government's investigation. He basically wouldn't give them key information that would enable them to make a determination. The government thought that that was not worthy of moving forward and worthy of dismissal. All this said, it's important to note that the government's dismissal motion, if it chooses to file one, is not necessarily the end of the case. Right now, there's a circuit split regarding the standard of review. The Ninth and Tenth Circuit mandate that the government show a valid government purpose for the dismissal. Other circuits, like the D.C. Circuit, the government only needs to has an unfettered right, so basically there's no showing whatsoever required for this dismissal. However, in either, the key is that if the government can show one of these seven factors, one, more, even something else, they'll more than likely meet either bar. Obviously, given the devastating damages attributable to the False Claims Act, give defendants a great incentive to settle them for a nuisance fee, no matter how meritless the claims might be. Having the DOJ act as a filter could go a long way to leveling the playing field and honoring the rule of law. However, the question remains, what changes, if any, will this memo actually precipitate? So at a conference earlier this week where there are a couple of DOJ attorneys talking about this, and the defense bar has been very active in talking about the memo too. So here's kind of what people are saying and where we think this might be going. The memo does a great thing, regardless of whether or not people actually move for more dismissals, in that it increases the sentiment that a dismissal is a good conversation to at least have. Notably, one thing that's really not tracked in the public and to which defense counsel are generally not privy are discussions DOJ has with relators' counsels behind the scenes. The idea generally is that if DOJ knows that the relator doesn't have it or that the case could result in bad law, they're going to engage the relators' counsel and encourage them not to go forward. Relators' counsel, of course, have some incentive not to take meritless cases forward if DOJ says that there isn't a case there. A lot of times, relators' counsel are representing their clients on contingency fees. If they know that they're not going to win at the end, then there's not a lot of incentive to move it forward. Interestingly enough, under the FCA, you are not allowed to have pro se relators. All relators must be represented by counsel. Generally, in these conversations, the DOJ tries to give the relators' counsel as much information as possible about the deficiencies of the case, potentially even that the agency would not be supportive or that the agency doesn't agree with the theory alleged. There is some evidence that this generally works and that the number of cases filed under seal is lower than the cases that go forward without intervention. In fact, one stat that's in the memo is that more than 700 cases have been dismissed by relators after the declination since 2012. The nice thing about this memo is that, you know, while the government could always threaten dismissal if the relator decided not to take the case forward, now, if it makes that threat, it has more teeth. They can say, look, you know that there's this memo out here that we're supposed to be thinking about this more proactively. We might actually move to dismiss this case if you choose to go forward, which could result in them not having to take that action and the relator just going ahead and dropping the case. But, you know, that's still one step short of the ultimate action, which of course has happened in less than 1% of these cases, is the government actually filing this motion. You know, we also talked a little bit about other things that would mitigate towards a dismissal or even increase discussions with relators' counsel about dropping the case. One of those that came up was the idea of getting a just result. If DOJ gets a whiff of a meritless case that's being brought by a relator just in an attempt to extract a settlement, they're probably going to push pretty hard on the relator's counsel, and it might indeed mitigate towards filing a motion to dismiss. And even if they don't decide to file a motion to dismiss under Title I, as mentioned in the memo, DOJ can also look for other grounds of dismissal that are not provided under Title 31, for example, the first-to-file bar, the public disclosure bar, the tax bar, ban on pro se relators, Rule 9b. The memo advises that all these should be asserted separately so that there can be an independent legal basis for dismissal. A couple things to keep in mind as practice points if you're a defense attorney in this field. The line attorney is probably not the one who's going to make the ultimate decision to dismiss. It's going to be either the U.S. attorney or main justice who has to weigh in on that decision. So when you're making a presentation based on these factors and a general declination presentation, it's a good idea to have at least some thoughts in writing or PowerPoint or detailed letter so that that line attorney can convey it up the line. And, you know, if it's strong enough, then maybe that will help merit a motion to dismiss. Overall, the general sentiment is that this probably won't be a sea change event in terms of these dismissals. However, I would expect to see more relators not bringing meritless cases or independently deciding to release the case before it becomes public, because if they're told that it's not meritless, because this is a hanging thread out there. With that, I think we're ready for some questions, hopefully.
Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you will hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. While we wait for our first question, I'll ask one of my own. Why do you think these dismissal provisions have been underutilized prior to this memo?
You know, that's a really good question. There are a couple things to keep in mind here. The first is that the end result of these cases, if they were to go forward and they're meritless, it's not a huge loss to the government in their minds. Yes, there's some monitoring fees, and yes, there could be discovery. Actually, discovery has become an increased cost recently after Escobar because now we can look more into government knowledge, which is an expense for the government. So that's a shift that might have helped help move this memo forward. One aspect is deterrence. Before, U.S. attorney's offices stand to benefit from treating relators favorably. Successful relators councils attract more relators, attracting more relators to particular districts, which helps them recover more money. So if they are actively dismissing these cases, it's unlikely that relators are going to keep coming to their district. Also, motion dismisses are a form of resource drain. They can only be filed with approval from Maine Justice. To obtain approval, they must submit a memo outlining the reasons the dismissal is warranted. Then they must deliberate, discuss, and then they have to actually file the memo, and then there could be appeals, et cetera. All those things require resources.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Our next telephone conference call is scheduled for Monday, February 5th at 10:45 a.m. Eastern, and that call is at D.C. Circuit Courthouse Steps on its decision to uphold CFPB constitutionality. That will be an RTP teleforum. A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming teleforum calls and to consult the full schedule of our upcoming calls by visiting the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded teleforum calls you may have missed. I'll make a final call for questions. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. How long do you think it will be before we have a good idea of how much this changes things, Brandon?
That's an excellent question. It's hard to tell. Obviously, the memo is out there now, and people in DOJ are actively looking at cases. It's not a situation where we have to wait for these things to filter all the way through from filing the QTAM to the investigation. That said, there is a deliberative process, so it's not going to be next week.
I'll make a final call for questions. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. I'll ask one final question. Was this an expected development, or was this unexpected?
So, interestingly enough, just last October, Michael Granson spoke at a healthcare claims conference, in which he said something that was reported later by industry as alluding to an increased desire to dismiss meritless False Claims Act cases. This got some media attention. A couple people reported on it, which prompted DOJ to come out maybe a week or so later and say, no, there's no policy shift. He didn't say that. That's not what was meant, et cetera. So it was a little surprising to see this come out this January, only a month and a half or so after the denials. That said, you know, we've known for a while that the Trump administration and DOJ would be interested in curtailing this kind of meritless lawsuit that are harmful to businesses. So I think yes and no might be the answers to your question.
Not seeing any questions, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our expert for the benefit of her valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.